Seattle's Morning News, and this being Monday, Jill Schlesinger is here, not only CBS senior business analyst, but author of a new book whose title is...
It's called The Dumb Things Smart People Do With Their Money, and I know you can't relate to that, though, because No. You don't do anything dumb.
Of course not. Let's talk about tax reform. I genuinely wonder, are we going to feel a tax cut here or not?
It really depends. It's a very strange tax season because, again, this is the first year that we'll be filing based on the new tax law. And so, you know, there are a lot of experts who say that about 2/3 of American households are going to get tax cuts in 2018. But some of you may have already gotten the benefit of that. You may have had fatter paychecks because withholding has been changed. And so the interesting thing is that when we go to file this year, your refund amount, who knows what it's going to be? It could be higher, it could be less. And it could kind of mask the impact that you might have received already, which is a good one. That, again, most people got a tax cut. And about 6% of those filing across the country will see a tax increase.
Right. But I also see that, for example, deductions, personal exemptions are gone. Deductions are limited. Deductions, for example, for property taxes. Do you get to take those or not?
Well, you get to take them, but it's a really interesting thing. If you remember, this was like a big last-minute kind of thumb in the eye for people who live in high-tax states. So the state and local income sales and property taxes used to be able to deduct that. Now it on an unlimited basis, and now it's limited to a combined total of $10,000. So that could really change the calculus for many tax filers. Also, I should just remind people that there have been big changes to the mortgage interest deduction. So if you bought a home after December 15th of 2017 and you had a very big mortgage, maybe a $1 million mortgage or something like that, you're not going to be able to deduct all of your mortgage interest. And also for those folks who are have home loans that are, you know, basically you're using, say, your home equity to try to pay off your credit cards, that cannot be deducted anymore. If it's for home acquisition or something related to your house, yes. But if it's to pay down other debt, you cannot deduct that amount.
And despite the shutdown, now officially over, refund should appear on time?
That's what the IRS had said. There was some speculation last week that with, you know, many thousands of IRS employees just not showing up, that would be impossible. But there's been no official, hey, don't expect your refund. So we're looking at the same, say, 3 weeks if you're an e-filer, 6 weeks if you're a paper filer. And, you know, the reality is that for many people this year, your tax filing could be easier because more people will claim the standard deduction. It's just that if you are really looking forward to a tax refund, it's just unclear whether or not you're going to get as big a refund this year as last year. Maybe it'll be even better. But of course, that refund, it just means you lent Uncle Sam some extra money for the year.
Right. Now for something completely different. I've been reading about China. And one of the things that concerns China, going beyond the whole trade thing, is that they have come to dominate this new technology called 5G, which promises instant, in the blink of an eye, internet access for your smartphone, but also some concerns that if we base our brand new 5G system on Chinese chips, we give them a back door to spy on us.
Yes.
Is this something that we ought to be worried about?
Look, this is a really interesting issue because for many years, the way that the U.S. technology sector viewed China was, yeah, they kind of hold us up and make us give them our technology, but they just use it afterwards and then they sell stuff and we don't really have to worry about them. Now it does appear that there's quite a bit of innovation taking place in China. Many of those folks actually are educated in the United States and go back to China. And the 5G network is a fascinating issue because, as you say, this has significant privacy issues for many of us. And it used to be that we were worried about privacy issues and 5G and Chinese technology with government-issued stuff. Now it's just all of us. With all the information flowing, there is some fear that China will come to dominate the technological landscape and really take a leg up on the U.S. tech sector. I think that it's almost like the warning shot has now been issued, and technology is U.S. technology companies are certainly springing up and trying to take control of this. But it is a big deal, and it is not. It's not the only reason, but it's a good chunk of the reason why there's so much contention around the administration and Huawei and the Chinese company that's leading the phone, the mobile phone charge, and what exactly is going to happen if the Chinese were to dominate that market.
How'd that happen? How did it get to the point that China didn't just eat our lunch trade-wise, but also became more innovative than us?
You know, I think that innovation is a really tricky thing. And I think that you can get a little fat, dumb, and happy when you've innovated. But the real issue is, how did China focus on what is clearly a much more important innovation, 5G, than, say, the latest app that is going to help you swipe left, swipe right, and find your mate?
Right.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm happy for love. But there is, it does appear that perhaps the U.S. took our eye off the ball, and specifically that, you know, you really need, we kind of have outsourced a lot of innovation to the private sector. Years ago, decades ago, the government would lead the charge for those kinds of innovation, hence the World Wide Web, for example. And we are relying on the public, the private sector to do that work. And the economic incentives have to be there for the private sector to move on it. I think now the incentives are everyone's a little nervous and the government's snapping to it.
CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger, Mondays on Seattle's Morning News. Seattle's Morning News. It turns out that January is a very bad month for cholesterol. Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, a new study shows that if you get your cholesterol checked in January, you're probably going to end up on a medication of some kind. Why is that?
Yeah, good morning, Dave. I think this is actually a fascinating study. It's a Danish study of 25,764 people aged 20 to 100. And they check their cholesterol at different times during the year. And what was really interesting was they found that people have higher cholesterol in January than they do in June. There's a steady rise from June through January where it peaks, and then it comes back down. So they tried to hypothesize what the causes of it were, and they came to the conclusion that it was largely based on the way that people ate around the time of Christmas and the New Year, eating foods that were, you know, high in fat and sugar. What they found was their cholesterol levels in January were about 20% higher than they were in June. And so they did make the recommendation based on their study that if you're going to go on a cholesterol medication, follow cholesterol periodically throughout the year before making a determination.
So if you were to get your cholesterol checked in January, when it might very well be at a seasonal high, and your doctor, as a result, gives you a prescription for a cholesterol medication, and in other words, you get a prescription you really don't need, will it harm you to take it? I mean, how strong are these medications? Is it dangerous to take a cholesterol medication if you don't have high cholesterol?
So the first line of defense against high cholesterol are the statin drugs. And the statin drugs have a lot of side effects. And for many people, they just can't tolerate taking them. And so kind of the most common complaint that people who don't tolerate statins well is they get like this muscle ache, or they can even feel like they have some weakness associated with it. But, you know, there are other things like headache, difficulty sleeping, drowsiness, dizziness. Some people feel sick to their stomach. Some people get abdominal cramping. So there's a whole host of different side effects that can come from taking these statin drugs. So you don't want to take them if you don't need them.
Yeah.
And really the first line of defense should be making a lifestyle change. So if you get a single high cholesterol reading, especially if it's in January, according to this paper, you really should repeat it over the course of the year. And concurrent with that, you should be making lifestyle changes, because it may be that you don't need the medication. And like I said, the medications can have a lot of unpleasant side effects associated with them.
Right.
Now, the other thing is to note is high cholesterol, it has no symptoms. You're not going to know you have it unless you do a blood test. And so a blood test is really the only way to detect whether or not you have high cholesterol.
So when you talk about lifestyle changes, I assume you're referring to exercise. But what about, for example, I've got a box of oatmeal that claims that if I eat it every day, it reduces my cholesterol. Is that true?
It actually is true. And that's one of the reasons people are eating a lot of oatmeal these days. I mean, oatmeal contains a soluble fiber, and this soluble fiber reduces one of the types of cholesterol, which is called low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, or it's the bad cholesterol as we know it. And so the soluble fiber can actually reduce the absorption of cholesterol from your diet into your bloodstream. It's actually recommended that if you eat 5 to 10 grams or more of soluble fiber a day, that you can actually decrease your LDL cholesterol. You know, a single serving of breakfast oatmeal contains about 4 grams of fiber. So if you add other foods over the course of your day, like fruit or bananas or berries, things that actually have a low glycemic index, so it doesn't affect your appetite and your blood sugar, but those kind of things, and you can get 5 to 10 grams of soluble fiber a day, and you'll actually reduce your cholesterol. And I mean, look, the key is prevention. So there's a whole host of kind of heart healthy lifestyle changes that we've talked about on other shows with other topics, but they kind of apply here. And these heart healthy lifestyle changes can lower your cholesterol and can prevent you from having high cholesterol in the first place. And so it's things like eating a diet, like I said, that's rich in soluble fiber, including fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, limit the amount of animal fat, and use good fats in moderation. If you're a smoker, stop smoking. We all know that's really bad. Mm-hmm. Try to get some exercise every day of the week if possible. 30 minutes, even a brisk walk counts. So as long as you're doing something about it and paying attention to it, you can really work on lowering your cholesterol.
Yeah. Can you just work oatmeal into your hamburgers when you're barbecuing during the summer and have it suck the cholesterol out before it even gets into your bloodstream?
Well, it's a clever idea. I don't know if anyone's tried that.
I have. I'm raising my hand. None of my guests seem to notice.
Well, there's the Dave Ross solution to lowering cholesterol. I mean, I love it.
Yeah. But they tasted kind of like oatcakes, but, you know, guests never complain.
Yeah, they never complain.
Dr. Gordon Cohen. Thank you, Dr. Cohen.
Thanks, Dave.
It is 6:50. What's wrong with that? I think it's a great idea.
An oatmeal in your hamburger.
Yeah.
Might as well put sawdust in there.
No. It's very, very, very different. If you the right amount of spices, a little onion, mushrooms,
all right.
Worcestershire sauce. How do we feel about public school students using medical marijuana on campus? And how do we feel about requiring schools to keep anti-overdose medication, presumably in the nurse's office? The legislature has to figure out how it feels about that, and that's what Kyle Radio's Hannah Scott has been looking into.
Okay, so the first bill, Dave, would be the one allowing students in K-12 schools to get medical marijuana while on campus. It's known as Duckey's Bill and has been an effort pushed by Democratic State Representative Brian Blake for more than 2 years.
What I'm trying to get at is some kids respond to this CBD oil therapy. This is not about smokable marijuana.
The bill is named for an Aberdeen student who suffers from seizures and who is prescribed medical weed to deal with them and does much better on them. But because pot is not allowed on school grounds, when he needs a second dose in the day, his school day is interrupted. He has to be taken off campus. Blake wants that to change for Ducky and any other student in that situation.
The way I envision this, the parent or guardian would make arrangements with the school, would be dosed at home, go to school. When they needed a second dose during the school day, the parent or guardian would show up. The child would come out of class, step into a private room, have a cookie that had CBD oil on it and a glass of juice, and then go back to class.
The school nurse would not be allowed to administer this. This would have to be the parent or the guardian coming. That kid would have to have a legitimate prescription, and then they'd have to go to a designated part of the school, give him that cookie or whatnot. And then he would, you know, presumably there wouldn't be that much interruption in his class day. That's the idea.
So how are other prescription drugs treated in schools?
It's the same. So there's certain stuff like EpiPens and things that schools are allowed to do. Otherwise, for the most part, it's the parents that I believe.
So the only reason that the marijuana-based drugs are treated differently was this blanket prohibition on anything involving marijuana.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one thing that is added to this bill that is a concern, they scrapped the whole plan if at any point the feds find out about it and threaten to take away any federal education funding because of it.
I see. So, why would the feds do that? That would be stupid. Right?
You would think, but okay. You never know, right? Another bill that they're looking at, a proposal, it would not only allow schools to use and administer overdose-reversing drugs like Narcan and Naloxone to students, but in some cases require that they actually have it on campus. Democratic Rep. Jerry Paulette behind this proposal.
This is an opportunity to move this bill forward, and literally, you know, you will save lives.
So this proposal would allow all K through 12 schools to have Narcan on hand if the districts choose to, and requires districts with 2,000 students or more to actually have it on their all high schools. Colleges with dorms housing 100 or more students would also have to come up with a plan to have it and have trained people to use it and recognize signs of an overdose. This paraeducator and mother urged lawmakers to approve the plan.
Narcan programs are available widely, but not in our schools. The training is simple and easy to understand. I get trained every year with EpiPens and AEDs. Narcan is much simpler. We all know someone who struggles with addiction. Having Narcan in our schools and colleges would greatly help decrease the emergency response and save lives.
She also brought her daughter with her to speak for the bill.
I'm a recovering drug addict. I've spent the past third of my life struggling with meth, heroin addiction. So the laws regarding Narcan really hit home, as there literally could be the difference between life and death for myself and many of my friends and loved ones.
There was plenty of support at this committee hearing for this bill, and some lawmakers, including Representative Paul Harris, wanted it to go even further.
I'm just concerned, honestly, at the limit of 2,000 students. So I would like to know accidental teen suicides in rural Washington dealing with opiates. To me, it's great to have 2,000 students, but is the life of a student in a smaller high school? I just find this really odd. So I'd like to look at what accidental teen suicide has been in some of our high schools throughout the state. And actually, I don't even really care. I think it just should cover everybody.
Yeah. All right. Well, what was the reason for the limit, the cost potential if you required smaller schools to carry the drug?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a cost issue there. It's a little bit, they came down with some numbers. It's a little more expensive, so that's something they're going to have to work out. Also, I think they were trying to focus on the urban areas. But he's right. There's opioid overdoses are a huge problem in our rural areas, both in schools and out. One thing that I couldn't get, and I know we talked about this before, is what's the number? Several of the lawmakers on this committee, do we know, is this a problem in schools? Do we have kids overdosing on campus all the time? There's really no tracking of that at this point. So I think the feel I got was, let's just make sure this is available and we can use that so we don't have those deaths on campus.
I assume that schools still teach just how dangerous these drugs are, regardless of how good they may make you feel in the moment, that it's like injecting yourself with poison.
Absolutely. I can tell you my daughter has learned that already in her health classes. But, you know, it doesn't. Some kids get into it a variety of ways. Some people come from homes where their parents are addicts. Others, you know, it can happen to anyone. It can happen to anyone. It can happen if a kid was given a prescription painkiller at some point, anything, or got into, you know, their parents' medicine cabinet.
I just saw the film Beautiful Boy about Did you see that film?
I know about it.
By the Rolling Stone reporter whose son was hooked. And you come away with that thing. Well, rehab, I mean, didn't they come down to the conclusion that rehab works maybe 8% of the time? That the only true way to help somebody is for them never to start.
That's true, but that's not the case. That's not the reality that we live in, right?
Yeah,
so it's unfortunate. So that's the argument. Again, I think this has a lot of support. It almost passed last session. You know, some would argue it's enabling. Others say just it's saving lives. There are kids out there doing this. There are kids out there who are going to OD. This will keep them from dying.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness now. A gesture of kindness is born from a Twitter battle between comedian Patton Oswalt and a Twitter troll who attacked Oswalt, who now says he's changed his life. NBC's Kathy Park has the story.
It started when Oswalt slammed the president's tweet, "Build a wall and crime will fall," with an R-rated response, writing in part, "You're going to resign." Michael Beatty took offense, tweeting at Oswalt, "I just realized why I was so happy you died in Blade Trinity."
Instantly and instinctively, my hackles went up and I said, "We can't have this."
Instead of getting even, Oswalt responded with, "This dude just attacked me on Twitter, and I joked back, but then I looked at his timeline, and he's in a lot of trouble health-wise. I'd be pissed off, too." Oswalt then directed his more than 4 million followers to Beatty's GoFundMe account and donated $2,000 to help with his medical bills.
It was the farthest from anything I would have expected.
The 64-year-old Vietnam veteran from Alabama went into a coma after serious health complications. But the unexpected help, now part of his healing.
Most important lesson that I got out of all of this, and that's when you take people individually, one-on-one, people are incredibly kind.
Beatty's GoFundMe page is now at 46,280.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. And now here he is talking to us on an encrypted line from his undisclosed location, Danny O'Neill. Danny, I watched the, we're having brunch at a place in Issaquah. They happen to have the Pro Bowl on 5 screens, so I couldn't avoid watching it. It was the first time I'd ever seen it, and it was a little like Dancing with the Stars. It was actually quite entertaining at times. And I noticed that the rules appear to be, as soon as somebody grabs you, just stop running and fall to the ground.
That's correct. There's very little resistance. I want to know this place where you had brunch where they were playing the Pro Bowl, though. That sounds like a contrast, a severe contrast in activities.
Well, no, it was a gentleman's sports bar, and
I see. Okay, so yeah. You can watch your Pro Bowl over your eggs.
That's right. Very
then
high
you serve
class.
A little bit of cantaloupe at the end.
Very high class place. So I assume nobody was hurt, and there also seemed to be very few penalties. So why not just play the game that way?
Well, that's pretty much how they do it, and that's the question of. People who are football fans feel very unsatisfied by that. I don't think many spectators enjoy it. Maybe someone whose eyes happen to glance across the screen, such as yourself, while eating brunch, will be like, oh, that's interesting. As far as a product, I can't imagine paying money to go see that. And I think that's kind of part of the contrast. The commissioner doesn't like it. He would rather eliminate it. The problem is the commissioner also wants to add meaningful regular season games, so the players look at it of like, hey, this is our reward. This is something we go and do, and people actually, the players like going to it because it's a distinction, it's an honor. You go someplace sunny, and you get recognized as one of the best, and they don't want to risk their physical safety, their bodies, in a game like that. So I don't know how you make it better. But I know that it is, as a game, it's pretty much unwatchable for me.
Huh. Well, I mean, it did seem like on a number of the plays that they decided just to sort of hug it out, and they all appear to be good friends. So, I mean, the vibe I got from it was, it was very positive. But I can see that if you're looking for the Clash of Titans, you're certainly not going to get it at the Pro Bowl. Does it raise money for something? And where does the gate go?
I don't know where the gate goes. I'm not sure. They've moved it around. It's usually in Hawaii, which I would feel bad for a guy that's a first-time Pro Bowler. And they're like, hey, you get to go to the Pro Bowl. And he's like, yeah, man, I'm going to Hawaii. And like, no, Orlando. Orlando is where it was this year. I'm not sure if it I can't imagine that it goes to benefit something, but maybe it does. I don't find myself particularly passionate about it. It's an exhibition. It's the worst of all the sports all-star games, but the players do seem to get some sort of enjoyment out of it.
All right, we finally have some resolution to the controversial non-call in the NFC Championship game. Nicky Roby Coleman got fined $26,739?
For a penalty that wasn't called, for a helmet, for hitting the head, blow to the head or neck area of a defenseless receiver.
Oh, I see.
So it's essentially the NFL saying, we took another look at it, we decided that this was worth a penalty. It doesn't change the outcome. The part that I find interesting is people in New Orleans, and specifically people around the Saints, have been seeking some sort of apology from the commissioner, as if that's going to make them feel better. Does it make anyone in New Orleans feel better to know that he should have been penalized on that play, or that he's getting fined for the penalty that wasn't called that cost them the game? I can't imagine that's going to make anybody feel all
well, I'm
that
curious
much better.
Now, if they find the guy who did it, that means they're convinced that an infraction took place. Isn't there any discipline for the ref who failed to call it?
That'd be a good question. Bill Vinovich is the officiating crew. There was a reporter out this weekend saying four of the officials there had ties to Southern California, which I was like, anyone who thinks that people with ties to Southern California wanted the Rams to win is dramatically overestimating the appeal of pro football in the Los Angeles area. He could be downgraded. I don't think he'll be fired. They usually don't make that stuff. They usually don't make that stuff public. But that's the part of it. Again, would that make someone in New Orleans feel better? Would they like that more if they knew that the guy got in trouble? I don't know if it would make up for anything.
Well, I'm not alleging some kind of Southern California conspiracy, but maybe, you know, a fierce letter in his personnel file or something. I mean, what is it? Don't refs from time to time have to be corrected and motivated to be more careful?
Yes, and usually that's kept internally. I just want to know when, as a country, we became such a group of wimps that we need someone else to be disciplined, or we need a letter of apology, and we just can't stay mad forever. That I'm going to be furious with this person. A good, old-fashioned, unrelenting grudge. Like, that should be your reward in and of itself. And as someone who is fueled by bitterness and hatred, I'd like to become an advocate for the undying grudge. That maybe it's something that'll motivate you and keep you sharp. And instead of wanting the referee to be disciplined, know that every time you hear his name said, you're going to wail in pain and shout an expletive.
I hadn't considered that. No, that's a good point. If you actually had done justice in this case, you would have removed something that people can now complain about for the rest of their lives.
Well, or the other thing is the actual administration of the justice, the sternly worded letter in the personnel file, you're going to realize it doesn't make you feel any better.
No, right.
And then you get back, like, what do you want more? Now we
right.
get to... It
what really makes you feel better is being able to complain about it forever.
Being really mad about it forever. Just furious, like teeth gritting. I'm talking about, like, the day that I die, the morning of the day that I die, I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be mad about that. I will still be moved to blinding anger about that. Kind of like me and Howard Schultz.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll have to talk about later because, darn it, we're out of time.
What? I can't talk about it?
Darn it, we're out of time.
Rip,
but, Danny, thank you very much.
Non-calf skin latte.
And I'll remind everybody that the Sports Insider is sponsored by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. See you later.
Talk to you soon.